You think you have won, she thought. We shall see about that. Satisfied with what she had done, and the inevitability of her terrible revenge, the Reverend Mother strode out of Harkonnen Keep. The Baron's Berserk followed her for part of the way, then let her return alone and unescorted to the shuttle like a chastened dog. Other guards remained rigid and at attention, guarding the foot of the ramp. Mohiam calmed herself as she approached the craft and finally allowed herself a slight smile. No matter what had occurred back there, she now carried another Harkonnen daughter inside her. And that, of course, was what the Bene Gesserit had wanted all along. How simple things were when our Messiah was only a dream. Stilgar, Naib of Sich Tabor. For parted kinds, life would never be the same now that he had been accepted into the Sich. His wedding day to Freeth approached, requiring that he spend hours on preparation and meditation, learning Freeman marriage rituals, especially the Ahal, the ceremony of a woman choosing a mate. And Freeth had certainly been the initiator in this relationship. Many other fascinations distracted him, but he knew he could not make any mistakes in such a delicate matter. For the Sich leaders, this was a grand occasion, more spectacular than any normal Freeman wedding. Never before had an outsider married one of their women, though Naib Hainar had heard of it happening occasionally in other sieges. After the would-be assassin Ulit had sacrificed himself, the tale told throughout the siege, and no doubt spread among other hidden Freeman communities, was that Ulit had received a true vision from God, that he had been directed in his actions. Old One-Eyed Hainar, as well as Sich elders Jarath, Aliyid, and Garna, were suitably chagrined for having questioned the impassioned words of the planetologist in the first place. Though Hainar gravely offered to step down as Naib, bowing to the man he now believed to be a prophet from beyond the stars, Kynes had no interest in becoming the leader of the Sich. He had too much work to do, challenges on a scale grander than mere local politics. He was perfectly happy to be left alone to concentrate on his terraforming plan and study the data collected from instruments scattered all around the desert. He needed to understand the great sandy expanse and its subtleties before he could know precisely how to change things for the better. The Freeman worked hard to comply with anything Kynes suggested, no matter how absurd it might seem. They believed everything he said now. So preoccupied was Kynes, however, that he barely noticed their devotion. If the planetologist said he needed certain measurements, Freeman scrambled across the desert, setting up collection points in remote regions, reopening the botanical testing stations that had been long abandoned by the Imperium. Some devoted assistants even traveled to the forbidden territories in the south, using a mode of transportation they had kept secret from him. During those frantic first weeks of information gathering, two Freeman men were lost, though Kynes never learned of it. He reveled in the glorious data flooding to him. This was more than he had ever dreamed of accomplishing in years of working alone as the Imperial planetologist. He was in a scientific paradise. The day before his wedding, he wrote up his first carefully edited report since joining the Sich, culminating weeks of work. A Freeman messenger delivered it to Arakeen, where it was then transmitted to the Emperor. Kynes' work with the Freeman threatened to put him in a conflict of interest as Imperial planetologist, but he had to keep up appearances. Nowhere in his report did he mention, or even hint at, his newfound relationship with the desert people. Kytane must never suspect that he had gone native. In his mind, Arrakis no longer existed. This planet was now, and forever would be, Dune. After living in the Siege, he could not think of it by anything other than its Freeman name. The more he discovered, the more Pardet Kynes realized that this strangely dry and barren planet held far deeper secrets than even the Emperor realized. Dune was a treasure box, waiting to be opened. Brash young Stilgar had recovered completely from his Harkonnen sword wound and insisted on helping Kynes with chores and tedious duties. The ambitious Freeman youth claimed it was the only way to decrease a heavy water burden upon his clan. The planetologist did not feel he was owed such an obligation, but he bent against pressure from the Siege, like a willow before the wind. The Freeman would not overlook or forget a thing like that. Stilgar's unwed sister Freeth was offered to him as a wife. Almost without the planetologist noticing, she seemed to have adopted him, mending his clothes, offering him food before he realized he was hungry. Her hands were quick, her blue eyes alive with a lightning intelligence, and she had saved him from many faux pas even before he could react. He had considered her attentions little more than appreciation for saving the life of her brother, and had accepted her without further consideration. Kynes had never before thought about marriage, for he was too solitary a man, too driven in his work. Yet, after being graciously welcomed into the community, he began to understand how quickly the Freeman took offense. Kynes knew he dared not refuse. He also realized that, given the many Harkonnen political restrictions against Freeman on this world, perhaps his marriage to Freeth would smooth the way for future researchers. And so, with the rising of both full moons, Pardet Kynes joined the other Freeman for the marriage ritual. Before this night was over, he would be a husband. He had a sparse beard now, the first of his life. Freeth, though hesitant to speak her mind about anything, seemed to like it. Led by pirate-eyed Hynar, as well as the Syadina of the Siege, a female religious leader, much like a reverend mother, the wedding party came down from the mountains after a long and careful journey and out onto the open sands rippled with dunes. The moons shone down, bathing the sandscape with a pearly, glistening luster. Staring at the sinuous dunes, Kynes thought for the first time that they reminded him of the gentle, sensuous curves of a woman's flesh. "Perhaps I have my mind on the marriage more than I'd thought." They walked single file onto the dunes, climbing the packed windward side, and then breaking a trail along the soft crest. Alert for worm sign or Harkonnen spycraft, spotters from the Siege had climbed to lookout points. With his fellow tribesmen keeping watch, Kynes felt entirely safe. He was one of them now, and he knew the Freeman would give their lives for him. He gazed at lovely young Freeth standing in the moonlight, with her long, long hair and her large blue-within-blue eyes focused on him, assessing, perhaps even loving. She wore the black robe that signified she was a woman betrothed. For hours back in the caves, other Freeman wives had braided Freeth's hair with her metal water wings, together with those belonging to her future husband, to symbolize the commingling of their existence. Many months ago, the Siege had taken all of the supplies from Kynes's ground car and added his containers of water to the main stores. Once he had been accepted among them, he received payment in water rings for what he had contributed, and Kynes thus entered the community as a relatively wealthy man. As Freeth looked at her betrothed, Kynes realized for the first time how beautiful and desirable she was, and then chastised himself for not having noticed before. Now the unmarried Freeman women rushed out onto the dune field, their long, unbound hair flying in the night breeze. Kynes watched as they began the traditional wedding dance and chant. Rarely did members of the Siege explain their customs to him, where the rituals had come from, or what they signified. To the freeman, everything simply was. Long in the past, ways of life had been developed out of necessity during the Zen-Sunni wanderings from planet to planet, and the ways had remained unchanged ever since. No one here bothered to question them, so why should Kynes? Besides, if he truly was the prophet they considered him to be, then he should understand such things intuitively. He could easily decipher the custom of binding water rings into the braid of the woman to be married, while the unbetrothed daughters kept their hair loose and free. The troop of unmarried women flitted across the sands in their bare feet, their footsteps floating. Some were mere girls, while others had ripened to full marriageable age. The dancers whipped and whirled, spinning about so that their hair streamed in all directions like halos around their heads. Symbolic of a desert sandstorm, he thought. Coriolis whirlwinds. From his studies, he knew that such winds could exceed 800 kilometers per hour, bearing dust and sand particles with enough force to scour the flesh off a man's bones. With sudden concern, Kynes looked up. To his relief, the sky of the desert night was clear and scattered with stars. A precursor fog of dust would be carried up in advance of any storm. The Freeman spotters would see impending weather with sufficient warning to take immediate precautions. The young girls' dancing and chanting continued. Kynes stood beside his wife-to-be, but he looked up at the twin moons, thinking of their tidal effects, how the gentle flexings of gravity might have affected the geology and climate of this world. Perhaps deep core soundings would tell him more of what he needed to know. In future months, he wished to take extensive samples from the ice cap at the northern pole. By measuring the strata and analyzing isotopic content, Kynes would be able to draw a precise weather history of Arrakis. He could map the heating and melting cycles, as well as ancient precipitation patterns, using this information to determine where all the water must have gone. So far, this planet's aridity made no sense. Could a world's supply of water somehow be hydrated into rock layers beneath the sands, locking it into the planetary crust itself? An astronomical impact? Volcanic explosions? None of the options seemed viable. The complex marriage dance finished, and the one-eyed Naib came forward with the old Sayyidina. The holy woman looked at the wedding couple and fixed Kynes with the gaze of her eyes, so dark in the moonlight that they resembled the predatory orbs of a raven, the total blue within blue of spice addiction. After eating Freeman food for months, each taste laced with the richness of melange, Kynes had looked in a reflecting glass one morning and noticed that the whites of his own eyes had begun to take on a sky-blue tinge. The change startled him. Still, he did feel more alive, his mind sharper and his body suffused with energy. Some of this could be a consequence of the enthusiasm for his research activities, but he knew the spice must also have something to do with it. Here the spice was everywhere, in the air, food, garments, wall hangings, and rugs. Melange was intertwined with siege life as much as water. That day, Turok, who still came to take him out on daily explorations, had noticed Kynes's eyes, the new blue tint. "You are becoming one of us, planetologist. That blue we call the eyes of Ibad. You are part of Dune now. Our world has changed you forever." Kynes had offered a smile, but it was only tentative, because he felt some fear. "That it has," he said. And now he was about to be married. Another important change. Standing before him, the mysterious Sayyidina uttered a series of words in Chakobsa, a language Kynes did not understand, but he gave the appropriate responses he had memorized. The Sikh elders had taken extreme care to prepare him. Perhaps one day, with more research, he would understand the rituals surrounding him, the ancient language, the mysterious traditions. But for now he could only make reasoned guesses. During the ceremony he remained preoccupied, devising various tests he could run in sandy and rocky areas of the planet, dreaming of new experimental stations he would erect, considering which test gardens to plant. He had vast plans to implement, and, at last, all the manpower he could possibly desire. It would take an incredible amount of work to reawaken this world. But now that the Freeman shared his dream, Pardet Kynes knew it could be done. It could be done. He smiled, and Freeth gazed up at him, smiling in her own right, though almost certainly her thoughts diverged widely from his. Nearly oblivious to the activities around him and paying little mind to their import, Kynes found himself married in the Freeman way, almost before he realized it. The haughty do but build castle walls behind which they seek to hide their doubts and fears. Bene Gesserit axiom. The dawn mists carried an iodine tang from the sea, rising from the wet black cliffs that supported the spires of Castle Caladan. Normally, Paulus Atreides found it peaceful and refreshing, but today it made him uneasy. The old Duke stood out on one of the tower balconies, drawing a deep breath of fresh air. He loved this planet, especially the early mornings. The fresh, pure kind of silence gave him more energy than a good night's sleep ever could, even in troubled times such as these. To ward off the chill, he wrapped himself in a thick robe, trimmed with green Kanadar wool. His wife paused behind him in the bedchamber, hanging on every breath, as she always did after they had been fighting. It was a matter of form. When Paulus didn't object, she came closer to stand next to him to gaze out upon their world. Her eyes were tired, and she looked hurt, but unconvinced. He would hold her, and she would warm to him, and then she would try to press the issue again. She still insisted that House Atreides was in grave danger because of what he had done. From below, shouts and muted laughter and the sounds of exercise drifted upward. The Duke looked down to the sheltered courtyard, pleased to see his son Leto already outdoing his training routines with the exiled Prince of Ix. Both wore body shields that hummed and flickered in the orange early morning light. The young men carried blunted stun daggers in their left hands and training swords in their right. In the weeks they had lived on Caladan, Romber had recovered quickly and completely from the concussion he'd received during their escape from Ix. The exercise and fresh air had improved his health, his muscle tone, his complexion. But the stocky young man's heart and his mood would take much longer to heal. He seemed all at sea yet from what had happened to him. The two circled and parried, slashing down, trying to judge just how fast they could move their blades without having them deflected by the protective fields. They challenged and pounced, striking with a flurry of attacks that had no hope of penetrating the other's defenses. Blades sang and ricocheted from the shimmering shields. "The boys have so much energy for such an hour," Helena said, rubbing her red-rimmed eyes. A safe comment, not likely to raise any objections. She took half a step closer. "Romber's even lost weight." The old Duke looked over at her, noting the age-sharpened porcelain of her features, a few strands of gray in her dark hair. "This is the best time for training. Gets the blood flowing for the entire day. I taught Leto that when he was just a boy." From far out at sea, he heard the clang of a reef-marking buoy, and the putter of a fishing coracle, one of the local wickerwood boats with waterproofed hulls. He saw the hazy fog lights of a trawler farther out, cutting through the low-lying banks of sea mist as it harvested melon kelp.
"Yes, the boys are exercising," Helena said. "But have you noticed Kailia sitting there? Why do you think she's up so early?"
The lilt at the end of her question made him think twice. The Duke looked down, for the first time marking the lovely daughter of House Vernius. Kailia lounged on a polished coral bench in the sunshine, daintily eating from a plate of assorted fruits. She had her padded copy of the Orange Catholic Bible beside her on the bench, Helena's gift. But she wasn't reading it. Puzzled, Paulus scratched his beard. "Does the girl always get up this early? I suspect she's not adjusted to our Caladan days yet." Helena watched as Leto pressed with fury against Romber's shield and slipped his stun dagger in, jolting the Ixian prince with an electric shock. Romber howled, then chuckled as he backed off. Leto raised his training sword as if scoring a point. He flashed a gray-eyed glance at Kailia, touching the tip of his sword to his forehead in a salute.
"Have you never seen the way your son looks at her, Paulus?"
Helena's voice was stern and disapproving. "No, I hadn't much noticed." The old Duke looked from Leto to the young woman again. In his mind, Kailia, daughter of Dominic Vernius, was just a child. He had last seen her in infancy. Perhaps his sluggish old mind hadn't seen her adulthood coming so fast. Nor Leto's. Considering this, he said, "That boy's hormones are reaching their peak. Let me speak to Thufir. We'll find some appropriate wenches for him."
"Mistresses like yours?"
Helena turned away from her husband, looking hurt. "Nothing wrong with it." He prayed with all his heart she wouldn't pursue that subject again. "As long as it never becomes anything serious." Like any lord in the Imperium, Paulus had his dalliances. His marriage to Helena, one of the daughters of House Richese, had been arranged for strictly political reasons after much consideration and bargaining. He'd done his best, had even loved her for a time, which had come as a genuine surprise to him. But then Helena had drifted away, become absorbed in religion and lost dreams instead of current realities. Discreetly, quietly, Paulus had eventually gone back to his mistresses, treating them well, enjoying himself, and careful not to produce any bastards from them. He never spoke of it, but Helena knew. She always knew. And she had to live with the fact.
"Never become serious?"
Helena leaned over the balcony to see Kailia better.
"I'm afraid Leto feels something for this girl, that he's falling in love with her. I told you not to send him to Ix."
"It isn't love," Paulus said, pretending to pay attention to the movements of the sword and shield duel below. The boys had more energy than skill. They needed to work on finesse. The clumsiest of Harkonnen guards would be able to wade in and dispatch both of them in an eye blink.
"You're sure about that?" Helena asked in a worried tone. "A great deal is at stake here. Leto is the heir to House Atreides, the son of a duke. He has to take care and choose his romantic assignations with forethought. Consult with us. Negotiate for terms. Get the most he can."
"I know that," Paulus muttered.
"You know it all too well."
His wife's voice became cold and brittle.
"Maybe one of your wenches isn't such a bad idea after all. At least it'll keep him away from Kailia."
Down below, the young woman nibbled on fruit, eyed Leto with coy admiration, and laughed at a particularly outrageous maneuver he had pulled off. Romber countered him, their shields clashing and sparking against each other. When Leto turned to smile back at her, Kailia looked at her breakfast plate with feigned aloofness.
Helena recognized the movements of the courtship dance, as intricate as any swordplay. "See how they look at each other?" The old Duke shook his head sadly. At one time, the daughter of House Vernius might have been an excellent match for Leto. It saddened him to know how his friend Dominic Vernius was being hunted down by imperial decree. Emperor Elrood, seemingly irrational, had branded Vernius not only a renegade and an exile, but also a traitor. Neither Earl Dominic nor Lady Shando had sent any word to Caladan, but Paulus hoped they remained alive. Both were fair game for ambitious fortune hunters. House Atreides had risked a great deal by accepting the two children into sanctuary on Caladan. Dominic Vernius had called in all his remaining favors among the houses of the Landsraad, which had confirmed the young exiles in their protected status, so long as they did not aspire to regain the former title of their house.
"I'd never agree to a marriage between our son and her," Helena said. "While you've strutted around with bullfights and parades, I've had my ear to the ground. House Vernius has been falling into disfavor for years now. I've told you that, but you never listen."
Paulus said in a mild voice, "Ah, Helena, your Richesian bias keeps you from seeing Ix fairly. Vernius has always been your family's rival, and they roundly defeated you in the trade wars. Despite their disagreements, he tried to accord her the respect due a lady of a great house, even when nobody was listening."
"Clearly the wrath of God has fallen upon Ix," she pointed out. "You can't deny that. You should get rid of Romber and Kylea. Send them away, or even kill them. It would be a kindness."
Duke Paulus smoldered. He'd known she'd get back around to the subject before long. "Helena, watch your words." He looked at her in disbelief. "That's an outrageous suggestion, even from you."
"Why? Their house brought about its own destruction by scorning the strictures of the Great Revolt. House Vernius taunted God with their hubris. Anyone could see it. I warned you myself before Leto went to Ix."
She held the edge of his robe, trembling with her passion as she tried to make a reasoned plea.
"Hasn't humanity learned its lesson well enough? Think of the horrors we went through, the enslavement, the near extermination. We must never stray from the correct path again. Ix was trying to bring back thinking machines. Thou shalt not make a machine in the..."
"No need to quote verses to me," he said, cutting her off. When Helena dropped into her rigid and zealous mindset, no rebuttal could penetrate her blinders.
"But if you would just listen and read," Helena pleaded, "I can show you the passages in the book."
"Dominic Vernius was my friend, Helena," Paulus said, "and House Atreides stands by its friends. Romber and Kylea are my guests here at Castle Caladan, and I will hear no more of this talk from you." Though Helena turned and vanished back into the bedchamber, he knew she would try to convince him again at some other time. He sighed. Gripping the balcony railing, Paulus looked back down to where the boys continued their exercises. It was more like a brawl, with Leto and Romber battering at each other, laughing and running around and wasting energy. Despite her self-righteousness, Helena had made some valid points. This was the kind of opening their age-old enemies, the Harkonnens, would use to try and destroy House Atreides. Enemy legal minds were probably already working on it. If House Vernius had in fact violated Butlerian precepts, then House Atreides might be considered guilty by association. But the die was cast, and Paulus was up to the challenge. Still, he had to make sure nothing terrible happened to his own son. Below, the boys fought on, still playful, though the old Duke knew Romber ached to strike back at the myriad faceless foes who had driven his family from their ancestral home. To do that, however, both young men needed training.
not only the required brutal instruction in the use of personal weaponry, but in the skills required to lead men and the abstractions of large-scale government. Smiling grimly, the Duke knew what he had to do. Romber and Kylia had been placed in his care. He had sworn to keep them safe, had given his blood oath to Dominic Vernius. He must give them the best chance they could possibly have. He would send Romber and Leto to his master of assassins, Ufir Hawat. The warrior Mentat stood like an iron pillar, glaring at his two new students. They stood atop a barren sea cliff kilometers north of Castle Caladan. The wind smashed against the slick rocks and blasted upward, rustling clumps of pampas grass. Gray gulls wheeled overhead, shrieking to each other, scanning for edible flotsam on the rocky beach. Stunted cypress trees huddled like hunchbacks, bowed against the constant ocean breeze. Leto had no idea how old Ufir Hawat was. The sinewy Mentat had trained Duke Paulus when he was much younger, and now the Master of Assassins fended off any appearance of age through brute force. His skin was leathery, having been exposed to harsh environments on many worlds during previous Atreides campaigns, from blistering heat to numbing cold, whipping storms and the hard rigors of open space. Ufir Hawat stared at the young men in silence. He crossed his arms over his scuffed leather chest plate. His eyes were like weapons, his silence a goad. His unsmiling lips were stained the deep cranberry of Sappho juice. Leto stood next to his friend, fidgeting. His fingers were chilled enough that he wished he had brought gloves. "When are we going to begin training?" He and Romber glanced at each other, impatient, waiting. "Look at me," I said, Hawat snapped. "I could have leaped forward and gutted both of you in the instant you exchanged those cute little glances." He took a menacing step toward them. Leto and Romber wore fine clothes, comfortable yet regal-looking. Their capes snapped about in the breeze. Leto's was brilliant emerald myrrh silk trimmed in black, while the Prince of Ix proudly sported the purple and copper of House Vernius. But Romber looked decidedly uneasy to be out under the towering sky. "It's also wide open," he whispered. After interminable silence, Hawat raised his chin, ready to begin. "First of all, remove those ridiculous capes." Leto reached up to the clasp at his throat, but Romber hesitated just a moment. Within the space of a heartbeat, Hawat had ripped out his short sword and slashed the tiny cord mere millimeters from the prince's jugular vein. The wind grasped the purple on copper cape and carried it like a lost banner over the cliff. The cloth flew like a kite until it drifted to the churning water below. "Hey," Romber said, "why did you—" Hawat sidestepped the indignant outcry. "You came here to learn weapons training. So why did you dress for a Landsrat ball or an imperial banquet?" The Mentat snorted, then spat with the wind. "Fighting is dirty work, and unless you intend to conceal weapons in those capes, wearing them is foolish. It's like carrying your own burial shroud on your shoulders." Leto still held his green cape in his hands. Hawat reached forward, grabbed the end of the fabric, snapped it, twirled it around, and in a flash had captured Leto's right hand, his fighting hand. Hawat yanked hard and thrust out with his foot to catch the young man's ankle. Leto sprawled on the rocky ground. Static spun in front of his eyes, and he gasped to catch his breath. Romber laughed at his friend, then managed to restrain himself. Hawat yanked the cape free and tossed it up in the air, where it blew out on the ocean winds to join Romber's. "Anything can be a weapon," he said. "You're carrying your swords, and I see daggers at your sides. You have shields, all of which are obvious weapons. However, you should also conceal an assortment of other niceties—needles, stun fields, poison tips. while your enemy can see the obvious weapons." Hawat took a long training sword and slashed it in the air. "You can use them as a decoy to attack with something even deadlier." Leto stood up straight, brushing dirt and debris from himself. "But, sir, it's not sporting to use hidden weapons. Doesn't that go against the strictures of..." Hawat snapped his fingers like a gunshot in front of Leto's face. "Don't talk to me about pretty points of assassination." The Mentat's rough skin turned more ruddy, as if he barely kept his anger in check. "Is your intention to show off for the ladies, or to eliminate your opponent? This is not a game." The grizzled man focused on Romber, staring so intently that the young man backed up half a step. "Word has it there's an imperial bounty on your head, Prince, if you ever leave the sanctuary of Caladan. You are the exiled son of House Vernius. Your life is not that of a commoner. You never know when the death blow will fall, so you must be prepared at all times. Court intrigues and politics have their own rules, but oft-times the rules are not known to all players." Romber swallowed hard. Turning to Leto, Hawat said, "Lad, your life is in danger too, as heir to House Atreides. All great houses must constantly be on the alert against assassination." Leto straightened, fixing his gaze on the instructor. "I understand, Thufir, and I want to learn." He looked over at Romber. "We want to learn." Hawat's red-stained lips smiled. "That's a start," he said. "There may be clumsy clods working for other families in the Landsraad, but you, my boys, must become shining examples. Not only will you learn shield and knife fighting and the subtle arts of killing, you must also learn the weaponry of politics and government. You must know how to defend yourselves through culture and rhetoric, as well as with physical blows." The warrior Mentat squared his shoulders and stood firm. "From me you will learn all these things." He switched on his body shield. Behind the shimmering field he held a dagger in one hand, a long sword in the other. Instinctively, Leto switched on his own shield belt, and the flickering Holtzman field glimmered in front of him. Romber fumbled to do the same just as the Mentat feigned an attack, pulling back at the last possible second before drawing blood. Hawat tossed the weapons from hand to hand, left, right, and left again, proving he could use either for a killing strike. "Watch carefully. Your lives may someday depend on it." Any path that narrows future possibilities may become a lethal trap. Humans do not thread their way through a maze. They scan a vast horizon filled with unique opportunities. The Spacing Guild Handbook. Junction was an austere world of limited geographic variations, unadorned scenery, and strict weather control to remove troublesome inconveniences. A serviceable place, it had been chosen as Spacing Guild headquarters because of its strategic location rather than its landscapes. Here, candidates learned to become navigators. Second growth forests covered millions of hectares, but they were stunted box trees and dwarf oaks. Certain old Terran vegetables grew in abundance, cultivated by the locals. Potatoes, peppers, eggplants, tomatoes, and a variety of herbs. But the produce tended to become alkaloid, edible only after careful processing. After his mind-opening examination, stunned by the new vistas opened to him through the melange surge, Demir Pilru had been brought here without a chance to say his goodbyes to his twin brother or his parents. At first he had been upset, but the requirements of guild training rapidly filled him with so many wonders that he disregarded everything else. He found he could now focus his thoughts much better and forget much more easily. The buildings of Junction, huge, bulging shapes with rounded and angular extrusions, were of standard guild design, much like the embassy on Ix,
practical in the extreme and awe-inspiring in their immensity. Each structure bore a rounded cartouche containing the mark of infinity. Mechanical infrastructures were both Ixion and Richesian, installed centuries earlier and still functioning. The Spacing Guild preferred environments that did not interfere with its important work. To a navigator, any distractions were potentially dangerous. Every Guild student learned this lesson early, as did the young candidate Demur, far from home and totally engrossed in his studies, to the exclusion of any worries about his former planet's troubles. On a black grass field, he was immersed in his own container of melange gas, half swimming and half crawling, as his body continued to change, his physical systems altering to adapt to the bombardment of spice. Membranes had begun to connect his toes and fingers. His body had grown longer than before and more flaccid, taking on a fish shape. No one had explained the extent of the inevitable changes to him, and he neither chose nor needed to ask. It made no difference. So much of the universe had been opened to him, he considered it a modest price to pay. Demur's eyes had grown smaller, without lashes. They were also developing cataracts. He didn't need them to see any more, though, since he had other eyes, inner vision. The panorama of the universe unfolded for him. In the process, he felt as if he were leaving everything else behind, and it didn't bother him. Through the haze, Demur saw that the black grass field was covered with neat rows of containerized candidates and their navigator trainers. One life per container. The tanks vented orange clouds of filtered melange exhaust, swirling around masked humanoid attendants who stood nearby, waiting to move the tanks when told to do so. The head instructor, a navigator steersman named Grodin, floated inside a black-framed tank that had been raised high on a platform. The trainees saw him more with their minds than with their eyes. Grodin had just returned from fold space with a student, whose tank was adjacent to his and connected with flexible tubing, so that their gases merged. Demur himself had accomplished short flights on three occasions now. He was considered one of the top trainees. Once he learned to travel through fold space by himself, he could be licensed as a pilot, the lowest-ranking navigator, but still vastly higher than he'd once been as a mere human. Steersman Grodin's fold space treks were legendary quests of discovery through incomprehensible dimensional knots. The head instructor's voice gurgled from a speaker inside Demur's tank, using higher-order language. He described a time he had transported dinosaur-like creatures in an old-style highliner. Unknown to him, the monsters could stretch their necks to incredible lengths. While the highliner was in flight, one had chewed its way into a navigation chamber, so that its face appeared outside Grodin's tank, peering in with a curious, wide-eyed expression.